discuss about Agasura. Agasura represents the mentality of being cruel to others, being envious, trying to get at people in an envious way. According to Gargasamhita, in his previous life his name was also Aga. He was a son of Shankasura. Very beautiful looking body, and he would go around sort of showing himself off and comparing his body with others and then belittling the other people if he felt they didn't look as nice as him. So one day he met Ashtavakra, who is a great sage, but he happens to have a particularly ugly looking body, actually bent in eight places and really like little deformed looking, really. So of course, for someone like Aga, who is really into this bodily consciousness and particularly comparing his bodily appearance with other people's bodily appearance and then making some snide remarks about their appearance, Ashtavakra really looked funny to him. So he laughed. He thought it would, Ashtavakra looked quite hilarious, and he just roared with laughter and made some nasty comments. So Ashtavakra cursed him, that you don't appreciate my body because it's curved in eight places. So I'm going to give you a body which will be curved all over, because snakes, they move by curving. So said like that, your body will be completely curved. He cursed him that you become the ugliest snake in existence. Snakes, of course, are not known for being very attractive looking, generally. But he told him that you'll be the ugliest of all the snakes. So then Aga appealed for some mercy, and the sage blessed him that he'd be eventually delivered by Lord Krishna, which is actually very merciful. I mean, if any of us got that sort of benediction whereby you're more or less guaranteed to go back to Godhead sooner or later, even though it may take some time, it's probably a pretty good deal. So then Aga, he was a snake, demoniac snake, and he lived for a long time. I'm not exactly sure when this particular incident occurred, but it was a long time ago. And eventually, he met Kamsa. And Aga at that time was like the snake king of a certain area. And Kamsa came and challenged him that, I want you to be subservient to me. You can remain king, but I'll be the emperor over you. But Aga refused. Agasura refused. So then there was a big fight, and Kamsa defeated Aga and took him back to his own palace. How he did that was he garlanded himself with Agasura, wrapped Agasura's body, snake body, around his neck like a garland. And this way he showed, I've defeated Agasura. So from that point on, Agasura became his menial servant. So Agasura then, as the servant of Kamsa, was ordered by Kamsa, as of course some time later on, he is ordered by Kamsa that you go and kill Krishna in Vrindavan. Krishna at this time is five. So Aga was very happy to get the opportunity, because he knew that Krishna had killed his sister and brother. We described yesterday how Aga is the youngest of the three, the younger brother of Putana and Bakasura. So he was very, very upset that Krishna had killed his brother and sister, and what he wanted to do was to kill Krishna and then make an offering of Krishna as like what they call pitapak or that sort of thing, an offering to the departed family members in place of sesame seeds and water. He was going to offer Krishna. This was his idea. So the day began with Krishna and the cowherd boys coming out of their homes, and as usual, in a very blissful and very boisterous way, this is like one particular characteristic of the relationship between Krishna and the cowherd boys, very boisterous. As we said, boys will be boys, so a lot of rough and tough and tumble and fighting and shouting and all that sort of thing, running here and there and up and down, and like that. So they all gathered with all their calves, and Prabhupada describes in the Bhagavatam the number of calves. The Sanskrit term is asankhyatai. Sankhya, of course, there's Sankhya Yoga. Sankhya Yoga means that system of yoga where you sort of enumerate all the different material elements, and you, it's like you have a picture of the material world departmentalized into all these different elements. Whenever you look around, you see in terms of these different elements. So that's Sankhya, to categorize. So here the term asankhyatai is used. Asankhyatai means numberless, innumerable. And Prabhupada says that we may speak of hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, billions, trillions, tens of trillions. But when we go further, we use the term asankhyatai. So, how many calves were there? More than tens of trillions. So, inconceivable, really. Asankhyatai, you just can't really put a number on it. So this is the nature of Krishna's pastimes. So many calves. If you think tens of trillions of calves, what area that would fill up? Well, I don't know, but it would be a vast area. But they were all playing around here in Vrajmandala and going up and going down and around every day, moving around. And even though it was such a vast number, it wasn't like the whole area just became totally overflooded. But they were all there within Vrajmandala and they could move around as a group. So sometimes the example is given about Vrajmandala, that it's like a lotus which opens and closes. When it's closed, then it's very small. And you can go from one place to another just like that, just in a very short time. Like when we read about Vyomasura, we hear, I don't think everyone's marked themselves present, am I right? In that pastime, Krishna and Balaram and the cowherd boys and the cows, they started from Nandagram. Then they had breakfast at Govardhan Hill, which is 20 miles or something like that, 25 miles, a long way. And then, before lunch, they were at Kamyavan, and Krishna killed Vyomasura there. So this means they moved maybe 50 miles or something like that in just 3 or 4 hours, including having a breakfast stop. So it's not like they were running or anything like that. But it was just this feature of Vrajmandala that sometimes the places are very close, so therefore Krishna and his friends could just go very quickly to another place. But at other times, when it opens up, then it's vast. And more than vast, it's unlimited actually. because it's not different from Goloka, so it's literally unlimited. So here we're talking about tens of trillions, more than tens of trillions. So it's just inconceivable. But they all fitted into Vrajmandala. And they were all able to move around as a group without having to go outside Vrajmandala. So Vrajmandala appears to have been in something like an expanded form for these pastimes. They were all decorated very nicely by their mothers. They all had their lunch boxes. Prabhupada said one time, "My only anxiety is what's in Krishna's lunchbox." That's the only thing I'm worried about. So, being boys and being a little, you know, getting a little tough sometimes they would steal one little boy's lunchbox before he'd know it was gone. And he'd see, oh, it was him who took it. But that boy would then somehow pass it to another boy without the first boy noticing. The first boy would come running over and then see that the boy who took it didn't have it. Then he'd see it getting passed to someone else. So he'd be chasing around, but he was always, you know, a little behind. So the Bhagavatam explains that after a while, the little boy would become frustrated and cry. So then immediately he'd be given his lunchbox back. So they would do things like that. Children do these things. Sometimes if they're not so soft-hearted, they don't give it back. And whoever's crying just keeps on crying. But Krishna's pastimes are not like that. When the devotees get to the point of feeling that, oh, it's too much, then Krishna steps in and saves them. So they would do things like that. Blow their bugles and horns, play flutes. A lot of them had flutes. Imitating the animals, imitating the frogs, making sort of like rude noises down wells. Then the echo would come back, and then they'd chastise that, "How dare you make such a rude sound?" Like there's someone down the bottom of the well. So all these types of things which boys do. Such an amazing thing, all these pastimes of Krishna. And there's very nice verse. Actually, it's selected by Jiva Goswami. I mentioned a couple of days ago one verse spoken about Mother Yashoda, that Brahma, Shiva, and the goddess of fortune, they never got mercy like Mother Yashoda. So that verse, and then this verse I'll just read now, and a couple of other verses, they're quoted by Jiva Goswami in one of his books. And he gives this collection five verses. And he says, these verses show, they are the most appropriate verses for showing the glory of Krishna and how wonderful he is with his devotees. So that verse about Mother Yashoda is one, and this other verse which I'll read now is another. It's 10, 12, 11. Itam satam brahma sukhanubhutya dasyam gatanam paradaivatena mayashitanam naradarakena sukham vijahru krita punya punja. You know that verse? I'm sure you do. Oh yes, Prabhupada liked the verse very much. All the cowherd boys used to play with Krishna, who is the source of the Brahman effulgence for jnanis desiring to merge into that effulgence, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead for devotees who have accepted eternal servitorship, and who for ordinary persons is just another ordinary child. The cowherd boys, having accumulated the results of pious activities for many lives, were able to associate in this way with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. How can one explain their good fortune? Kritapunyapunja, how can you explain their good fortune? So there was a discussion, I think last night, was it? Oh no, night before, in Nectar of Instruction about the type of good fortune that people need in order to get devotional service. It means, it's called technically bhakti unmukhi sukriti. You may, those of you who are taking Nectar of Instruction would probably know that. Means unknowingly performed Krishna-related activities. Not that you have a mood of devotion and you're rendering service, but somehow or other unknowingly you're engaged in a service which in an activity which is related to Krishna. Like, for example, you just happen to be walking down the street and there's a Harinam party and you can't avoid it. You hear the chanting of Hare Krishna. You may like it or not like it, but that is an unknowingly performed Krishna-related activity. That sound vibration touches the heart. Or you take a book on the street and it's not that you're thinking that, oh yes, I must take this book about Krishna consciousness. Like so many people, you just say, well, all right, I'll take the book. And you just take it. Or you take some prasad. You don't know this is transcendental food. You just think, well, they're giving a free meal, so I'll eat some. So in your mind, there's no consciousness of Krishna, but the activity is related with Krishna. So it's called bhakti unmukhi sukriti, a pious activity which is of the nature of bhakti, even though it's not like consciously performed bhakti. It's one type of ajñāta sukriti. Ajñāta means unknowing, and sukriti means pious activity. So there are three types. I mean, I don't want to really get into that whole discussion now, but one type leads or produces the result of material sense gratification, like just mundane pious activity, helping sick people and things like that. Another type leads towards liberation, gives some little impetus in the direction of liberation. That means like fasting, unrelated to Krishna consciousness. Some people, they just fast from time to time. So that's a pious activity. It's unknowing, it's not that you're thinking, let me make advancement towards Brahman realization, but unknowingly you get a little impetus from that activity in the direction of liberation.
I didn't realize that it was ajñāta sukriti. I thought even if you performed it knowingly, it was still in that category.
Yeah, that may be also. Yeah, it can be knowing or unknowing, but in so many cases it's unknowing, and like the contrast is seen more when it's unknowing. The people just don't know; they just do it. And yes, it's true. Some people may know, but that if I take prasad, I'll benefit spiritually. But they don't have bhakti. It's more just like jnana, in a sense. They just happen to know a few things about Krishna consciousness. Yeah.
But it's still, it depends on transcendental.
Yes, exactly.
Eventually,
yeah.
It'll
build up, yeah. And then manifest. It manifests in faith, or the beginnings of faith, meaning that the person feels some impetus that, let me now get into Krishna consciousness a bit, like that. Let me go and associate with the devotees. It all builds up, and the manifestation when it's built up to a certain point is that one feels some attraction, which is the beginnings of Shraddha. So, the cowherd boys, what did they do? Well, it's not just a matter of unknowing Krishna-related activities, but of course, They were great, great, pure devotees, and they managed to achieve the association of Krishna. Of course, some others were eternal associates also. But in the case of those who previously were in material life, then it's understood that they became great devotees, and then they were able to enter Krishna's pastimes. So then, Agasura comes on the scene, an 8-mile long python, lying down, opening his mouth, his upper lip is touching the clouds. And the cowherd boys, initially, they're a little, not really perplexed, but just interested. What is this? Is it a new scenic spot? When they thought, we know this area, and it didn't look like this a few days ago. So it's not just some new scenic spot. It's a creature. Is it dead or alive? Then they thought, oh, it must be alive. What was like the main thing which encouraged them to think it was actually alive? You know, Mataji? His hot fiery wind, which was the breath coming out of his mouth, giving off the bad smell of burning flesh because of all the dead bodies he'd eaten. So he, of course, was a really horrific person. So then the boys, they were thinking, yes, it's definitely a creature, and it's definitely alive, and it's definitely dangerous, and it looks like he wants to eat us. Then they are thinking, well, so what are we going to do about it? Then they thought, let's just go in. Let's just go into his mouth. Don't worry about it. We know it would appear he wants to eat us, actually. That's his motivation for lying there like this. But let's just go in anyway. Because if it's a fact, as it appears, that he does want to eat us, then Krishna will save us, as he's done so many times before. So let's just go. So therefore we find in the Bhagavatam a very nice painting of the cowherd boys entering the mouth of Agasura. Krishna is standing in the foreground, you may know the picture, with his sort of like this. He is actually perplexed. He's thinking, well, what to do now? But the cowherd boys going into the mouth of Agasura, they're very happy. They're dancing and singing and waving their arms around, and it's just a very happy pastime. But they know that this monster wants to kill us. But they're feeling secure because they have this knowledge of Krishna's potency, which brings up a very interesting point about the inhabitants of Vrindavan and Krishna in Vrindavan, as opposed to Krishna and the inhabitants of other parts, Krishna as he appears in Dwaraka and other places. That in Dwaraka, Krishna is in the mood of manifest Aishvarya Shakti, his opulence or his potency as God is manifest. But sometimes it becomes unmanifest. And then he comes under the control or enters into a state which is called Madhurya Gyan. Doesn't actually mean specifically conjugal, knowledge of conjugal relationship, but it means knowledge, a consciousness of sweetness. So sometimes in Dwaraka, Krishna enters the state of Madhurya Gyan, a consciousness of sweetness, and he forgets his position as God. Sometimes. And the devotees also. Generally they're in a mood of Aishvarya Gyan in Dwaraka, but sometimes they go into the mood of Madhurya Gyan, like, well, in Mathura, because it also applies in Mathura, when Krishna and Balaram returned from Vrindavan and killed Kamsa, then they were reunited with Vasudeva and Devaki. And first of all, Vasudeva and Devaki were very conscious that they're God. Krishna and Balaram are God, and we must worship them. But as Devaki was looking into the eyes of Krishna, then she lost that mood of that Aishvarya Gyan, and she became overcome by Krishna's sweetness. And then she took Krishna and breastfed him, even though Krishna at the time was about 11 years old. Still she felt impelled like that. And then she and Vasudeva felt concerned that we have abused these boys. We haven't been proper parents. They haven't received any education. And they're 11 years old. All they've been doing is running around playing. So, this is all in the mood of Madhuri again. Now, in Vrindavan, generally everyone is in a mood, including Krishna, of Madhurya Gyan, being overwhelmed and bewildered by sweetness. But sometimes they go into the mood of Aishwarya Gyan. But when they do, it doesn't overcome the mood of Madhurya Gyan. So here, the cowherd boys, they're showing this very clearly, that they're aware Krishna's God, actually. He's killed these big demons. He's so powerful. So if we go into Agasura's mouth, then he'll protect us. So this is Aishwarya Gyan. But at the same time, they don't lose their mood of intimacy and friendly affection for Krishna. He still remains their friend. Whereas in the case, for example, of Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, he was also in the mood of Madhurya Gyan, but then he saw the universal form, and what happened? He became overcome, and he lost that mood of Madhurya Gyan, and he started apologizing to Krishna for having treated Krishna in intimate ways. This is a very interesting thing about Vrindavan. And Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur explains that this is the basis of the concept of sweetness. That there's a mixture of Krishna's divinity and his unlimited Shakti with his human feature. There's a mixture, but his human feature is not overcome by his greatness. If it was just a matter of being like a regular child, but just a particularly nice regular child, then it wouldn't be the same. But because there's this touch of Aishwarya, and it doesn't overpower, though, the Madhurya, then you get sweetness. So, the cowherd boys, they went very happily dancing into the mouth of Agasura, and Krishna, under the influence of Yoga Maya, was wondering what on earth to do. So he thought, I better go in and save them. So he went in. And when he went in, he expanded his body. So his body blocked the throat of Agasura. Agasura couldn't breathe. He started to suffocate. So then there was like a competition between Agasura and Krishna. Krishna was expanding his body, and Agasura was expanding his throat. But eventually Agasura got to the limit of his ability to expand his throat. But Krishna just kept expanding his body. So Agasura fainted. He suffocated and died. So when he died through suffocation, the soul, or Agasura, the living entity, burst out of his head and hovered around until Krishna came out. Krishna stayed a little while longer inside Agasura to revive the cowherd boys and calves, because they were all dead actually. So he brought them all back to life with his glance, came out, and the soul, Agasura, then came and entered Krishna's body. So the Bhagavatam explains Agasura got Sarupya Mukti. He got Sarupya Mukti. He achieved a body like, looking like Vishnu's four-armed form. Why? Bhagavatam says that he had some little trace of devotion for Krishna. How come? Because of his relationship with Putana. It ran in the family, somehow. So there was just something there in that family. So he got Sarupya Mukti, not Sayuja. Generally these demons get Sayuja Mukti, they just merge. But he actually got Sarupya. For a moment, he thought of Krishna with devotion. In real terms, Prabhupada gives a very interesting analysis of cruelty from a spiritual point of view. To illustrate it, Prabhupada gives the example of a child who has, I think, typhoid, or some sort of terribly serious disease, and his brother sees him suffering, and his brother thinks, oh, what a shame, let me be nice, let me be merciful, let me give him something to eat, like some deep fried something savory. So he's thinking, oh, this is very nice, this is mercy, but actually it's cruelty. So, because anyone who has a disease like that, if they eat something deep fried, it just makes things much worse. So Prabhupada gave that example to illustrate that we shouldn't get confused between what is material mercy, which simply will implicate people further in material existence, and what is real mercy. Real mercy can only really mean to give people Krishna consciousness. Like when we're distributing prasad on Food for Life, it's not that we're just trying to feed people who are hungry. Hungry people get fed, that's a fact. But ultimately the idea is that they'll benefit in Krishna consciousness. And the fact that they're hungry and they get a free meal is just like a secondary consideration, really. So real mercy, real kindness, the opposite of cruelty, is to give Krishna consciousness. So we, of course, having come from material existence, our hearts may be a little hard. The Bhagavatam says that that any person who, when they chant Hare Krishna, then tears don't come to their eyes immediately, and their bodies don't shiver in ecstasy, then their hearts are steel-framed. Means very hard heart. So, generally when we chant Hare Krishna, I don't think tears come to our eyes, and I don't think our bodies shiver. So that means we're still hard-hearted, despite the fact that we may have been trying to practice Krishna consciousness even for many years. So, you know, we have to be a little realistic and consider ourselves in terms of the description of Shastra. In Madhurya Kadambini, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that if you chant and these symptoms of ecstasy don't come, then it means you're committing offences. And you may say, what offences? You may not know what offences. So don't think that you aren't committing offences, but understand that you're in ignorance and that you're not understanding what your offences are. But the proof is, because you don't experience some symptoms of ecstasy, that's proof that you're committing offences. So, as we were hearing yesterday, Prabhupada was recommending, if you want to get purified so that you can sit and chant Hare Krishna and relish the holy name, then don't think, let me just come to Vrindavan and sit down and chant and then it's all going to come. Prabhupada was saying that Lord Chaitanya didn't tell us just to chant. Of course, he did also tell us to chant, but actually the process which he gave was preaching. So Prabhupada was saying, vigorously preach. And in relation to becoming cured of the tendency to be unmerciful, this is what is recommended, preach. And in this way, our own consciousness and our own sense of mercy, Krishna conscious sense of mercy, will be aroused. Then envy. In Srimad Bhagavatam, one person is mentioned who is like the acharya for envy. Who's that? Anyone know? Daksha. Prabhupada says that Daksha is the embodiment, the incarnation of envy. So, of course, we're also envious there within our hearts. Srila Baladev Vijayabhushan gives a very nice definition of envy. He says, envy means searching to find fault in the midst of many good qualities. He says this is envy in his Bhagavad Gita commentary. Searching to find fault, even in the middle of many good qualities. Looking, where's a fault, where's a fault? Trying to push the good qualities aside so you can see through and see if there's any fault. So this is envy. Prabhupada, there's one nice comment Prabhupada makes. Since no one in this material world can tolerate another's advancement, everyone in the material world is called Matsara, envious. In the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, it's therefore said that Srimad Bhagavatam is meant for those who are completely near Matsara, non-envious. In other words, one who is not free from the contamination of envy cannot advance in Krishna consciousness. In Krishna consciousness, however, if someone excels another person, the devotee who is excelled thinks how fortunate the other person is to be advancing in devotional service. Such non-envy is typical of Vaikuntha. So, of course, material life means that we try to see our own good qualities and amplify them, and we try to see other people's bad qualities. And, of course, if any bad qualities are apparent within ourselves, we try to overlook them. Even if we only have a scrap of good quality, then we become very attached. Just like Prabhupada actually referred to, I don't know who, if it was Al Capone, or I think it was one of Al Capone's associates who was sentenced to death for murder and all these things, all sorts of horrible, horrible activities. No, it was, anyway, he was one example. But one of Adolf Hitler's main people who was hung at Nuremberg, in the end, he was asked if he had any last words. He said, "I never meant to do anyone any harm." So people are like that. And the seed is there, and it's even there within our own hearts, that if someone tells you, "Look, you have this fault," then you may say, "What? How can you say that?" But you look at some other person and immediately, if you study a little, you see some faults. So spiritual consciousness, Krishna consciousness, means we see our faults and we appreciate the good qualities of other devotees. Just like Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, as the very nice example in this regard, saying that I'm lower than a worm in stall. I'm so low. But everyone else, he says, my audience, I just take the dust from your feet. And all the devotees, I take the dust from your feet. So we should try and cultivate this type of attitude, trying to appreciate our own defects and trying to appreciate the good qualities of others. Then this tendency to become envious will be, we can become free of it. Otherwise, spontaneously, we'll be inclined to appreciate our own good qualities, and spontaneously, we'll be unable to recognize other people's good qualities. There's an interesting description in the Bhagavatam of how all the bad qualities are related to each other and sort of help to generate each other. It's where, fourth canto, chapter 8, that from greed and cunning, their personalities, greed and cunning, From greed and cunning were born anger and envy. So they were brother and sister, perhaps. Then from their combination came Kali and Harsh Speech, who is his Harsh Speech is a female. So from their combination, brother and sister combined, produced death and fear. From death and fear came excessive pain and hell. So they're all linked up together like this. So if in Krishna consciousness we try to cultivate the ability to see our own deficiencies and other devotees' good qualities, Prabhupada appreciated this very much, Vaikuntha consciousness. Any comments or questions? Dr. Matt?
I'm just curious, how do they get the authority to become people in Krishna's
name? That's a good question. Well, sorry, what was the question? How do they get the authority? I know in the case of Nalakuva and Manigriva, Prabhupada makes the comment that Krishna knew that Narada had given them that specific curse, which part of it was that they would be delivered by Krishna. So therefore, Krishna, respecting that promise, Krishna then sort of did his duty, he fulfilled the promise. Now how Narada in the beginning got inspired to think, well, I'll sort of force Krishna to do something. To be quite frank, I hadn't thought about that. I'll think about it. I don't know if anyone else has any ideas on that subject specifically. Do you do, Milaji?
There was just a case which is a little similar right now. The wife of Dhritarashtra was very angry with Krishna after the battle of
Kurukshetra. Right.
She was so angry. She said, "Now, I'll curse that your family will be also destroyed by it." Krishna thought, "Oh, that's a good idea. I was not doing that wind up over
the past time." And she mentioned the time after another, either 31 or 32 summers. Yes. Anyway, to be quite frank, I hadn't thought about that. But it appears to be happening like that. Of course, these sages, some of these, including Narada Muni, Narada Muni is Trikalagya. He knows past, present, and future. So, you know, there may be some sort of connection there that he may know actually what's going to happen. So he makes a curse to fit in with what he knows is already going to happen. Now whether it applies to Ashtavakra also, quite frankly, I'm not aware of that. But it's an interesting point. Yeah, but still we can't say that the sages are just working like robots. Words just come out of their mouths. No, they're actually consciously, they make a decision to curse in this way or that. Yeah. Anyway, we could research that a little. That's an interesting sort of technical point. Any other comments or questions, Radhaji?
The good qualities, how do we balance that with being intelligently discriminating so that we can know who to associate with, or if we see somebody who's going wrong in their philosophy and might feel the need to speak up? How do we balance?
Well, it is discussed in Chaitanya Charitamrita about Ramachandra Puri. Paramananda Puri says it's not a fault to not criticize. I mean, it's not a fault sometimes to glorify, but to criticize is always a fault. So generally as devotees, we should be very charitable actually in our attitudes towards other devotees. understanding that we have like this deep-rooted tendency to not just objectively see a fault, but to actually get a little carried away about it. So that's why, you know, devotees, often some other devotee will have a number of faults, but also some good qualities, because, you know, generally both will be there. And only the devotee will generally only really sort of pay a lot of attention to a fault if the fault is particularly prominent or appears to be particularly dangerous. In other words, what we're suggesting is not just like sentimentalism, but that we use our intelligence to try and see. And if you use your intelligence, that means you'll also see the faults. But if your attitude is that actually I want to really like appreciate the good qualities, then you'll be prone to sort of discount the faults. But then, as I say, if a fault is really prominent, then seeing you're acting on the platform of intelligence, sufficient intelligence, hopefully, then you would see, well, actually, you know, this is really a fault, and it's dangerous, so therefore I should be careful. But, you know, because this tendency to become envious, it's really there, and it's really something prominent. As a general rule, we find that devotees, the great devotees, they're appreciating good qualities in other devotees. That's a very, very, very prominent part of their character. In fact, well, a number of the acharyas, Rupa Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they point out that there are 26 qualities of a devotee. Of them, one is called the Swarup Lakshana, or the essential quality. The other 25, they're called Tatastha Lakshana, or marginal qualities. So both Rupa and Vishwanath say that as long as a devotee has that one essential quality, you know what that is? That they're attached to Krishna. As long as they have that one essential quality, like it's there, then even if they're lacking in the other 25, then we don't really take so much notice. Unless that lack is really prominent, then we may have to be forced to, like, you know, to focus on it. And it's not that such a devotee would not be aware that the other devotee is lacking, but because the devotee has that one good quality of being attached to Krishna, then the devotee is mainly concerned with that. You know, otherwise you can get into this whole thing like psychoanalyzing other devotees and, you know, where is he or she at, and but you don't really need to do that. Generally we can just accept devotees because they're very nice, and it's nice to do that. But then if there's some prominent fault, then intelligently we can respond to that. Prabhupada would say, like the bee, as opposed to the fly. That's our meant to be the attitude of the devotee, looking for the nectar in one's association. Some other comments or questions?
I see Krishna's friends when he enters into the love of demons.
Yeah.
And when they thought Krishna will save us.
Yeah.
How can we apply this example?
Oh, I see. Well, first thing is, we're not on the level of the cowherd boys. Well, the basic idea is that how can... The cowherd boys were very confident that Krishna would protect them. Therefore, they just went into the mouth of danger. And they didn't care. So how can we apply this? So saying we're not the coward boys, so we shouldn't just like willfully endanger our bodies. We should really think, what's the best way to serve Krishna, not how can I get into the most dangerous situation and then just see how Krishna will save me. Because seeing we're not the coward boys, Krishna might not save us, or he might save us, but in a different way, by letting us undergo some suffering. and then we might learn a lesson, and in that way, it's like in effect saving us. If you follow what I mean. Anyway, our idea should be, let me serve Krishna in the best way. Like if you're on Sankirtan, think, where can I distribute the most books? Like that. That sort of idea. And then when we're doing that, danger is going to be there. We don't need to go out of our way to find it. There's enough danger around. So when the, you know, different situations occur which are difficult, then we pray to Krishna, and we can think, yes, Krishna will help. Whatever, as long as I stick at Krishna's lotus feet, then whatever happens will be his mercy. Maybe he'll deliver me altogether and there won't be any pain. But even if there is pain, it's just Krishna purifying me, teaching me a lesson. So like that, in that sort of mood. I was just reading the other day on com, some girls, brahmacharinis, were distributing books somewhere in what used to be Yugoslavia, and they went up to one soldier, drunk soldier, and gave him a book in one of their many languages in that area. So they gave him a book, but it was in the wrong language for that soldier. He happened to be, you know, on the other side. So he saw, you know, he was drunk. Now, this is a book in the language of our enemy. So this means you're our enemies. So he took his machine gun and he emptied the whole magazine, like 30 shots, at these girls. Fortunately, they weren't hit, because he was drunk. He was just sort of in a drunken semi-stupor. So, you know, it's not that we should go looking for situations. Not that they were looking, it just worked out like that. But we shouldn't go looking for dangerous situations, because, you know, we might get shot. It can easily happen in situations like that. So danger's there. We don't need to look for it, but we should just try and do our service. And while we're doing it, depend on Krishna. Now, one thing, a couple of things. First of all, we can pass these out. These are questionnaires about, you can make some comments about the course. What you think about it. This is for the Matajis. Any suggestions? And like that. So we're actually meant to fill it out before we can you keep passing them around. We're really meant to fill it out ideally before we finish right now. We can. So if you have any suggestions which you feel are practical, which we could apply, then don't be afraid to make them. Second thing is, tomorrow we're having our little test, just a little test, nothing to be scared of. I'll tell you all the questions. Well, I already told you some of them. I'll tell you the rest. So we already told you, we want to know the four reasons Krishna closed his eyes when Putana came to breastfeed him. Four. There are four. We want the four. They're there. They're there. To be found in your books. It's not difficult to find them. Then any five of the arguments or five of the ideas that Narada had as he was deliberating about what to do about Nalakuva and Manigriva. And I mentioned yesterday, I gave some examples, that he raised the question, whose body is it? We think it's my body and I can do with it as I like, but whose body is it? Is it your body? That's one. That would be one answer, that it may be your body. It could be your father's body. That's another one. It could be your mother's body. That's the third one. And there are various others. You get the idea? And there's so many other ideas that he explains about the benefit of poverty. So he gives different reasons why he feels poverty may be suitable for Nalakuva and Manigriva. Anyway, any five. Any five. Hmm? Then anathas, there are three sets of anathas, those on the level, more on the level of Bhajanakriya, those more on the level of anathanavritti, and those which are more at the end of anathanavritti. So we gave you those sets of notes about them. So we want you to learn any one group. Like the first group on the level of Bhajanakriya, there's six. So you would learn those six if you wanted to do that group. Or if you wanted to do the group which are more related with anathanavritti as such, then there's four. Right? So any one group with its members, with a little, like one or two sentences about each one. Then, now some new ones. Any five of the demons we have discussed so far and the anathas they represent, like Putana represents the pseudo-guru, and Agasura represents cruelty and envy. So like that, any five of the ones who we've studied so far. Much, because I have to mark it all. Unless I get some volunteers. So keep it brief. Like with Putana, I would accept pseudo-guru. Now if you said pseudo-guru, which can be a person, like Sai Baba, or the mind, well that's also better. But you'd probably just get the same marks if you just say pseudo-guru. But it should be clear, like in the case of Agasura, it appears to be three. They're like very, very closely linked. Cruelty to others and envy, or causing harm out of envy. So if you were to want to choose Agasura as one of the five, then I'd want to see those two, cruelty and envy. No, any five. We've studied more than five. Five. We want any five. Five. Yes. Any five. One, two, three, four, five. Out of, we've done, I'm not sure, seven or eight or nine or so far. Okay, then, last. From these two harmonist articles, I hope this is not too much, is it? See, it has to be a test. We can't just make it like nothing. You have to write all your tests tomorrow. We're studying here. We're not here to play games or have a holiday. So any three points from each article. So that means both Putana and Vatsasura. Any three from each. Now when I say points, I mean that, like if you turn back to page 25, at the bottom of the page, you'll see I've extracted 6 points. Just the idea was really just to help the reader to grasp what is being said, because I know the language is a little difficult in the article itself. So any three from each article, that means six. Three times two. Not six from one, but three from each. Three times two. And that's it. You got it. Number two. Yeah. That on pages 18 and 19 of our course book, Narada Muni is deliberating in his mind, what should I do about these boys? So he thinks of different things. He thinks about the fact that they're in bodily consciousness, and then he raises the question in his own mind that why are they thinking that they have the right to use their bodies in these ways? They can't really say that their bodies belong to them. Then he gives a number of people who the body may belong to. So each one of those people is one. And we want five. And it doesn't have to just be that. Yeah. Actually, there's so many points. There's probably like 20 or 30 points which he discusses. Now, on top of all this, this is something else altogether.